Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And welcome back, Genies. It is Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, and ExtremeGenes.com, where we shake your family trees and watch the nuts fall out. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, and today we're going to delve into one of the most educated minds in family history research. He is Gary Boyd Roberts, one of the most prolific family history writers of the last several decades. His specialty is gateway ancestors, those ancestors that most of us have that have proven lines back to royalty. Now, why do royal lines matter? Well, it's not just snob appeal. Gary will explain when he joins us in about 10 minutes. You'll be amazed how much knowledge about colonial ancestors, class mobility, and royal lines, your lines, are crammed into this man's head. If you have Southern roots, you're going to want to hear this. Same for Mid-Atlantic and New England. Also later in the show, our preservation authority Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com returns with answers to two of your questions. One has to do with restoring and making copies of a 19th century photograph from Louisiana that can't be removed from a bubble glass frame. What to do? Tom has the answer. And what about that massive collection of photos you digitized several years ago? They could be in danger of being lost. Tom will tell you what to do to make sure that doesn't happen to you. Have you got a story, comment, or question? We'd love to hear from you. Our toll-free Extreme Genes phone line is 1-234-56-GENES. That's 1-234-56-GENES, G-E-N-E-S. We want to hear what you're up to, what you're discovering, and how we can help you break down those walls. There's a lot of family histoire news out this week. First up, Forbes.com has a fascinating story about how scientists are now working on how to take DNA from a crime scene and create a mugshot of the suspect. Yes, a group of scientists have been able to make 3D models of people's faces using their DNA. Now, the models are admittedly crude, but they feel they will get this science to the point where the predicted faces could be used to at least eliminate certain suspects. They have done it by studying genes that, of course, have everything to do with the structure of the face, including correlating specific facial structures to people who have those particular genes. From these and many other scientific methods, which are way over my head, they've been able to create statistical models to come up with an approximate face from DNA. Now, if you were at Roots Tech in February or watched online, you may remember that a member of Ancestry's team said that the day is coming when your DNA will be able to tell you the eye color of your fifth great grandfather and maybe his hair, as well as height and other specific traits. It sounds like the directions these scientists are taking can have many applications, including one for genies throughout the world. Find the link to the story at ExtremeGenes.com to get the specifics, especially if you're an interested scientist. The New York Times is reporting that Yale University has learned that the man they have long honored as their first African-American graduate was not, in fact, the first. Edward Boucher is the name long recognized at Yale. He graduated with his bachelor's degree in 1874 and continued his education to earn a Ph.D., the first African-American to do so there. But recently, an Americana specialist in New York at Swan Auction Galleries came across a collection of 95 late 19th century documents. For the most part, they were pretty ordinary. But as Rick Statler began studying them, the name of Richard Henry Green popped up. Well, in the course of his normal evaluation of the material, Statler visited Ancestry.com and learned in an old digitized publication that Green was named as an African-American graduate of Old Yale, something the people at modern-day Yale were unaware of. The American Educational Annual from 1875 specifically named Green as the first African-American to graduate from Yale as part of the class of 1857, almost two decades prior to Edward Boucher. Green was born in 1833 and passed the Yale entrance exam in 1853. He was very engaged in campus life and was a member of Sigma Delta Fraternity and the Brothers in Unity Literary Society. A campus newspaper from the time of Boucher in the 1870s had stated that Boucher had been the first, so that designation had long been accepted. Yale regularly issues the Boucher Leadership Awards in minority graduate education, and even have an oil painting of him hanging prominently in their library. Yale spokespeople say that Boucher's place of honor will remain, especially considering his achievement of earning a PhD. But now Richard Henry Green will also take his rightful place in Yale history, having graduated 4 years before the start of the Civil War. We've linked to the story at extremejeans.com. The Washington Examiner reports that cemeteries are going green. And we're not just talking lawn here. The historic Congressional Cemetery has been given the certification of hybrid service provider from the Green Burial Council, whatever that is. According to the cemetery, green burials mean no embalming and no concrete vault. Also, the casket must be eco-friendly. Wicker or plain wood with no hardware are examples. In fact, some people are being buried there in just a shroud. Yes, you can leave flowers. And in the case of the historic Congressional Cemetery, you don't have to have served in Congress or the judicial branch. You merely have to have given up the ghost. And finally, the Associated Press tells us that a somewhat cryptic letter written by soon-to-be President Abraham Lincoln has essentially been decoded. The letter was addressed only, "My dear sir," and a piece of it had been removed from it. It was written during the 1860 election, and Lincoln asked the receiver to, quote, keep up a correspondence with an unnamed person. Well, an organization called the Papers of Abraham Lincoln ran that phrase through a database and came up with some matches to that phrase. As a result of those, they now believe the letter was sent to an Illinois man named Leonard Sweat, a fellow Republican, who was trying to get a newspaper editor in Albany, New York, Thurlow Weed, to support Lincoln for the Republican nomination. Well, Weed eventually did come around to Honest Abe, and that is some detective work, especially after 154 years. And that's your family histoire news from the pages of extremejeans.com. If you find an interesting family history story you'd like to share with us, send it on to me at fisher@extremejeans.com. And coming up next, whether your roots are Southern, from the mid-Atlantic states, or New England, you may very well descend from royalty. Why does it matter? Well, our next guest will lay it out for you. He's an expert on gateway ancestors, American immigrants with proven descent from royal lines. He's Gary Boyd Roberts, long associated with the New England Historical and Genealogical Society, one of America's foremost researchers and writers on the topic. He's going to cover a lot of ground on the subject coming up in 5 minutes on Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, and ExtremeGenes.com. Welcome back to Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, and our guest today is Gary Boyd Roberts, a Texan-born researcher in Massachusetts who is very well known for all the books that he's done, linking us back to the kings. Now, you know, everybody, Gary, descends from paupers and from kings, and you chose the king side for some reason. Why is that?
Yes, because they're traceable.
Yes.
all the other groups you're likely to descend from will disappear in the sense of not being traceable at a certain point. Kings will take you back to the ancient world.
Wow, that's a great point. I would have never thought of it. I think a lot of people think, well, if you're tracing back to the kings, you're looking to satisfy a certain ego. But the reality of it is the kings do take you back farther than anybody else.
The children of kings are nobles. The children of nobles are gentry, the owners of settled estates, you know, those that are inherited by the eldest son. And the children of the gentry are soldiers or bureaucrats or intellectuals at Oxford or Cambridge or Harvard or Yale. And these upper middle class people who ran America for a long time mostly have a strand of this gentry, noble, and royal ancestry.
Now, how many people do you think within the country have a royal connection through early American ancestors?
Oh, probably 100 million or more.
So about a third.
I should think. It's a matter of how much colonial ancestry you have, how many ancestors who came here by 1775. And for those people who have quite a bit of such ancestry, having an immigrant of royal descent, they're about 400 or 500, actually a little over 500 numbers of colonial immigrants who have that kind of ancestry. It's hard not to have one of those 400 or 500 as an ancestor.
Yeah, I would think so. And I'm aware of two in my line.
And I don't know how many, you know, the average is for somebody like that. But we're talking mostly, when you talk about the colonial ancestors, you're talking about people from Virginia and, what, the mid-Atlantic states, New York, Pennsylvania, and then Massachusetts, of course.
Yes, they're largely the Puritans who were basically preachers and governors in Massachusetts. You're talking about large landowners in the mid-Atlantic and Quakers. An enormous number of both English and Welsh Quakers have these kinds of lines. And then Virginia planters with some Maryland planters and Carolina planters as well.
So which has the most, you're saying Massachusetts probably with the most gateway ancestors?
I think Virginia, actually.
Really?
But it's much easier to trace people after they arrive in New England. It's a smaller population. We're much better documented. But there are actually more such immigrants in Virginia. Virginia was peopled by 1,000 probably for every one New Englander.
So,
or 100 to 1 is probably more like it.
How many have you identified personally?
Well, I've identified, I have a volume that's about to come out, or will be out in 2 years, on the royal descent of 800 immigrants. Now, that's about 500 again in the colonial period. And then I deal with such modern people as Werner von Braun and Dag Hammarskjöld and Audrey Hepburn and Olivia de Havilland and Joan Fontaine and Anna Wintour of Vogue, the wife of Ezra Pound, and so on. These are modern immigrants that people don't generally descend from, but immigrants with such ancestry have been coming over for the full 300 years, and almost all of them will have among their descendants for five generations somebody who's notable.
So what is the most common royal link? I mean, is it all to England, or is some of it into Germany?
Yes, it's to England. It's usually to Edward the First or Edward the Third, grandfather and grandson. The third died in 1377 and the first in 1307. We also almost all descend from Capetian kings of France. You may remember that when Louis the 16th was executed, they called him Louis Capet. And we descend from Hohenstaufen, German emperors, the family of Frederick Barbarossa. Then Frederick Barbarossa had a daughter-in-law who was herself the daughter of an emperor of the East. And from
Hold on, Gary. I'm working on my flowchart here, trying to keep track of all these places. That is absolutely astonishing.
It has to do with genealogical patterns in largely Western Europe, and Western Europe is quite mobile, people coming up and down the social scale, largely in Britain, somewhat lesser extent in France. The closer you get to Russia, the more separate the classes are and the less intermarriage or mobility. America is probably the most mobile country that is derived from Europe.
That is a great answer, because I wondered how it was that so many people would come from royal descent and then somehow wind up, you know, farming in Connecticut. And that answers that question. That is amazing.
Well, you have all of these often minor leaders, but colonial governors, preachers, landowners. And, of course, when they get here, any successful culture overpopulates. And so the great-great-grandchildren of governors and major ministers who organized New England, those people can become ordinary farmers. And then the successful ones, especially on the East Coast, eventually became the social register after having been tycoons or intellectual figures or people involved in the Age of Sail. And those who did not prosper, so to speak, became ordinary farmers and eventually moved west.
We're talking to Gary Boyd Roberts. He's the well-known researcher into gateway ancestors. So if you have a certain family name, you may find out that you are descended from the kings of England, of Western Europe, Eastern Europe over the long period of time. He's got another book coming out in a couple of years. So Gary, give us some names. If somebody's listening right now, give us the most common names that may come up, that may tell somebody, I've got a documented line back to royalty.
Well, the biggest in terms of numbers of notable descendants is Governor Thomas Dudley of Mass. The second one is Anne Marbury Hutchinson, the great Anne Hutchinson, the religious heretic who has a statue here in Boston. The third is a Samuel Appleton of Ipswich, Mass. And the fourth and fifth are the Livingstons of New York and the Randolphs of Virginia. Then there's a much more obscure immigrant, Dorothy Thompson Park, who is an ancestor and really her mother, Alice Freeman Thompson Park, a rather ordinary immigrant with a very minor strand of royal descent that came into Stonington, Connecticut. And she's a good example of those people who are here and will surprise you with ancient ancestry, which you usually will be surprised by. But then there are the others, the Dudleys and Hutchinsons and Livingstons and Randolphs, whom everybody knows from history books.
Yeah, I would say. So how many descendants do these people have right now, do you think, living?
Well, there are about 100 million people in the country with mid-Atlantic or southern ancestry, about 100 million with New England ancestry, and 100 million who are descended from 19th and 20th century immigrants. But we're all intermarrying very fast. And so this ancient swath of ancestry going from the ancient to the feudal and medieval worlds and then down to American colonists and down to, oh, say, the suburban middle class of today, most educated urban dwellers, most people who've had the chance and the background for education, almost all of these people have this kind of ancestry. They have lots of other kinds of ancestry, which again are untraceable after a certain point, but they have a strand or two going back to these kings, and from these kings, they can go back, before they were kings, there were tribes, and tribal chieftains, and the tribes that invaded Rome in about 400 A.D., and you can get back to kings of Armenia, to those of Cyprus, and ultimately to the Ptolemaic pharaohs of Egypt, and there are possible lines from Greece. There were no biblical lines, and there are no Muslim lines for Westerners, but there are lines from a large number of other ancient cultures.
So whether you're Southern, Midwestern, Western, or Eastern, we could all share in this kind of ancestry.
Yes, and you also have people such as Tip O'Neill's wife and others who think of themselves as Irish or Italian or whatever, but who will have a Yankee grandmother or great-grandmother. Mark Wahlberg is such a person, and who thinks of himself, no doubt, as Swedish and has a French-Canadian royal descent, but also has a Yankee and is descended from the Hawthorns of Salem. This is Mark Wahlberg, after all. And so a large number of ethnic people, people who, again, think of themselves as Irish or Italian, will have a chunk of this ancient ancestry that comes down through a Yankee forebear that they may or may not be really aware of.
All right. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, Gary, I want to talk about some of the inaccurate lines. There have been a lot of them that have been published over the years, how those have been disproved, how many are being disproved, and how many are being added to the list of gateway ancestors. When we come back on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. We are back at Extreme Genes Family History Radio, ExtremeGenes.com. It is Fisher here with our guest, Gary Boyd Roberts, the nationally renowned researcher who has discovered so many gateway ancestors. But, Gary, you've also disproven quite a few over the years. And
well, a lot of people have disproven them. I tend to like to add them up.
Yeah.
Other people like to tear them apart. I had a book published in 93, another one published in 2004. Those dealt with 500 and 600 immigrants, respectively. I eliminated 2030. I'm eliminating 11 in this edition and adding about 90. And many of those you add are more contemporary, whereas the ones you delete are usually colonial. But we're finding more colonials, I would say, four or five per year. And that adds up over 10 or 15 years. So again, it was RD 593, RD 600 in 2004, and when I come out with a new one about 2015, it will be RD 800.
Wow. Royal Descent, RD. So here's a question for you. As you go back into the Royal records, how accurate are those records, do you feel?
Well, the records having to do with the gentry are fairly good. The records are fairly good. But the conclusions change all the time, and new
right.
things are found all the time. The ancient world changes. The genealogical facts change all the time. English origins of the Great Migration, people arriving in New England 1620 to 40, those change all the time. What doesn't change is a line from a medieval king or a duke down to Lafayette, or Tolstoy, or the wife of Hernan Cortez, the conqueror of Mexico. Those lines that have been noble for 400 or 500 years, those are usually quite accurate. It's when you're shifting classes and becoming more or less mobile that breaks can occur and assumptions can be made. It was often thought that someone named Lawrence would have to be the son of the knight of that name who lived nearby, when he's probably the son, or often enough, the son of a fourth cousin.
Now, you came out with a conclusion not too long ago about George Bush the Elder and,
yes,
and his descent.
Yes, I think it was the first president who is related to about half the American people. His ancestry, that's 8th to, say, 13th cousin, his ancestry is fairly evenly divided, one-third Southern, and there is a kinship to Pocahontas' descendants, not a descent from Pocahontas, but a kinship to all of her descendants. At any rate, a batch of mid-Atlantic ancestors, especially Quaker again, and a large number of New England ancestors. His children have 12 immigrants of royal descent.
Wow.
And Laura has one that's fascinating. It's back to de Graffenried, a Swiss count who comes in and is a landgrave in North Carolina. Most of the rest of George Bush's royally descended ancestors are from, well, it's about half divided between New England and Virginia, I should think.
And so as a result, he is related to, like you say, about half the population of the United States.
I should think so. Again, if you've got 100 million people, almost any immigrant of the period 1620 to 40 will have several million descendants. You can almost say that you have to have that many in order for someone to write a book, some descendant to be interested enough to write a book chronicling it all. So if you add millions of descendants for each immigrant, and you obviously deduct 75% or more for overlap, but if you add all those together, you get a huge percentage of the American people with these lines. It's been estimated Diana, Princess of Wales, had about 25 American forebears of the Great Migration. She's 1/8 American and 1/64 New England Yankee. At any rate, she's probably related to 30 million Americans, and the number of Americans with Mayflower descent is probably between 30 and 50 million. Some people think that's an exaggeration, but once they get here, families, again, often overpopulated. You hear of these huge families of between 5 and 12 children, of whom about half survived and went out west or whatever, and so the descendants become enormous in number.
So the challenge now for everybody as they go on is to find who these people are, because this is the line that is likely to take you the farthest back and tie you to historical records. Fascinating.
Yes. And it's almost never your father's 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 father's
no.
father. It's always someone you've never heard of as a boy. Your mother's father's mother's mother's father's mother's father's mother's mother's father, who indeed you never have never heard of. And the patrilineal line that you thought was so great, usually it's not. There were a great many tycoons, especially, who tried to make, like DuPont, for example. And a few of them really do have such lines, patrilineally. But most, again, it's through maternal families they've never heard of. And most of the lines proposed for tycoons and for other early hereditary society members in the 1880s or 90s, most of those have been massively revised, and other royal descents have been found. So there's a constant adjustment. The people who thought they were of royal descent 100 years ago usually are, but not the way they thought.
So let me ask you this. You've got hundreds of gateway ancestors, those who came over 300-400 years ago who go back to the kings. Which one is the closest descent from royalty?
There's a Nelson pair in Raleigh that are descended, Raleigh, Mass., that are descended from a sibling of George, Duke of Clarence, Richard III of Shakespeare's plays, and Edward IV, who was the grandfather of Henry VIII. There are possible descendants of Henry VIII. It's often thought that he had a mistress, Mary Boleyn, sister of Anne. She had two children named Henry and Catherine for the king and queen, the then queen, Catherine of Aragon. They have about six greater great-great-grandchildren who came to the colonies. They have millions of descendants, and these are all possible descendants of Henry VIII.
Wow, so that's really pretty close. You're only talking 3-4 generations.
Yes, that's true. And then we have some modern people like Hugh Grant or Rupert Everett or people of that sort who may even descend from Charles II. Jessica Mitford of The American Way of Death is a descendant of Charles II and who died in 1685 and again had a large number of mistresses.
Wow. I mean, you have packed a lot of information into this, Gary, and you've been doing this since how old?
I saw the movie Royal Wedding when I was about 8. I was born in 43, and I can remember my mother telling me at the time of the movie that the princess, meaning Elizabeth, had just had a little girl, Anne, who was born in 1950. So I probably became interested about age 7 or 8. This aunt told me we were descended from the Duchess of Devonshire shortly thereafter, so my fascination with kings and royalty and my fascination with genealogy went together and have somewhat governed or composed the intellectual content of my life. And I devised this theory that there was a sociological component to the modern world. We used to be ruled by popes and kings, then we were ruled by a nobility, and the last 500 years have been the European gentry and European-derived, and that they have basically governed the modern world. And I spent my life exploring the pedigrees that will prove that.
Fascinating stuff. Gary Boyd Roberts, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining us today.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
And coming up next, it's our preservation authority, Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, to tell you how to preserve those old films, those old movies, those old pictures that are so important to all of us. He'll be here in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority. Good to have you again, Tom.
Awesome to be here.
And we got some questions in, as usual, from AskTom at TMCPlace.com. This one from Alina Hatch in Peoria, Arizona. I've attached a photo of an 1894 photo of my great-grandmother I came across in Louisiana. The original was under a bubble glass frame and could not be removed, which is why there is a bright reflection in the center of the photo. Any chance you all may be able to work your magic and remove the glare?
Oh, absolutely. There's all kinds of magic we can work with that. First thing we usually want to do is we want to scan it at a high resolution. And then once it's scanned, we can do what they call dodging, which is, you know, fix some bright spots, fix some dark spots. And the picture to send up, which I will hold up to the mic so our listeners
can see it. Oh, perfect. Look at that, yes.
Look through your speaker. If you're driving, don't wait till you get home and watch the podcast. Then after we do that, we can repair, like there's some on this picture that she sent in there, you can see some little tears in it and some spots and things. We can take those out, and then once all that's done, then we can print it at high resolution also. So it'll actually look better than the original photograph.
Isn't that fun? And,
oh,
and I do a lot of this photoshopping at home myself, and you can do amazing things now.
Oh, absolutely. Now, one thing I would recommend if you have situations like this, too, if you have something in the glass that it's actually glued to the glass, whether it's, you know, moisture or heat or whatever caused it to do that, the best thing to do is when you're going to take a photo of it, use something with a polarizing lens because that will get rid of the glare, or put it in a good lighted area where it has diffused light like fluorescent lighting and turn off the flash on your camera because the camera's going to, you know, flash off the glass. You're going to see those spots like her photo has. And so if you turn all that stuff off, you'll be able to get a lot better shot of it. Now, a lot of times, too, if you adhere to a glass where it's not rounded or concave like this glass is, you can take it to some professional scanners that have high-end equipment, and you can take it out of the frame, but you don't have to take it off the glass. You can take the glass and put down on their machines because they have special software that's built into their equipment to get rid of glares and things like that. So once they do it, they'll be able to take away some of the problems that are going to be associated with it.
So you're saying that if you actually do a scan of something that's under glass, you will not get a reflection?
If you use a polarizing filter, correct, or you take it to a professional such as us, and then we can scan it with our special software, and it will automatically remove that glare and look to what's behind it.
So what's something like that cost, Tom?
It's not really too bad. This picture has a lot of work that needs to be done in it, but with all the scanning, the dodging, the repairing, and actually making like an 11 by 17 print, you're still usually looking at under $100.
Oh, wow. That's a great deal. And,
oh, yeah.
And you get a treasure that's actually better than the original.
Oh, exactly. And in this picture, you can see parts of the picture actually missing that we can go and recreate those. We have had situations where we've done photos for people where we had to take somebody out or they were the last person in the line and their shoulders cut off. So we actually go in and build them a new shoulder.
Give them a new shoulder.
Exactly.
Very little charge.
No
Obamacare necessary.
Yep. No long-term care, no pain. It's really, really easy to do. And it's pretty inexpensive. Most people that contact us think this is going to be hundreds and hundreds of dollars to do. But generally, it's pretty inexpensive. It's not that much work. It's mostly just the time you're paying for. If you're taking a shot of something that's concave, like this lady sent in to us, you want to make sure, again, that you have very diffused lighting, so nothing's reflecting off of that. Turn off the flash on your camera and try and get it right over the top of it. And sometimes on like iPhones and things like that, you can't put a polarizing lens on it. So just kind of move your camera around to where you can see the best shot of it and shoot it. You don't have to have it perfectly centered. As long as we can see the whole photo, we can go in and clean it up.
Well, hopefully that answers your question, Elena. Tom Perry, our preservation authority from tmcplace.com. And, of course, Tom has the answers to all the questions, and you can ask him questions anytime you like at asktom@tmcplace.com. And this one is from Edgewood, Washington, Tom, from Brant Gibson. He says, I have a question about digital photo preservation. I have a couple thousand digital photos, and I've heard you need to open your photo files every few years to make sure they work with new software. Is this true? And if so, with so many pictures, what's a good and reasonably fast way to do this? Good question, Brant.
That's an awesome question. And that just proves that everything you hear on the internet or read on the internet is not true.
Love that. And that's why you're here.
Exactly. And a lot of times people don't go into enough detail when they're saying, hey, watch out for this, don't do this. I believe what Brant's looking for, or what he's hearing, this is mostly for like software, like old, when computers were first out, they had different companies making things like Microsoft Word, but it wasn't Microsoft Word, and they've gone out of business. And we have people bringing in floppies to us constantly with old programs, and they want them put on a CD, which we can take the documents and put it on a CD for them, but it's still in the exact same format that they brought it into us. And if they can't access some software or a newer software that will read that, they basically have document files that are totally unreadable. And I'm pretty sure this is what Brant's looking at, is old software that's no longer available. But on photos, you shouldn't have that problem. If you saved them in like JPEGs, TIFFs, PDFs, RAWs, formats like that, because they've been around for a long time, and I would be surprised if they ever go away because they are basically the industry standard.
Right.
Whether you're using Microsoft or you're using an Adobe product or anything else, these are very, very standard. So what you want to do is if you do have these files that are in something strange, open them and make sure they do open. And then a good program to use is Photoshop. Go in and do batch files, do batch conversions. And so if you have thousands of files, you can set up and say, okay, this folder, I want you to do this. Go and set it up, walk away from it, and it'll rock and roll. And when you go in the documentation, a lot of times you might not find something exactly like that. Go onto Google and type in a Google search, and you might find somebody that's found a way to write a real easy script that you can put into Photoshop that will do this for you.
Really?
Oh, yeah, and they're pretty easy. I've had photos that I wanted to look a certain way, like an old-fashioned picture, but it was not a normal sepia tone, but I had seen it before, and I would go on and Google it and find out somebody had already written a script for it. And you can download the scripts. They're usually free, and they can do all kinds of things to your photos, make them look like old-fashioned photos, clean up your photos, turn them into, you know, JPEGs or TIFFs or PDFs or whatever it is you want them to be. And then once you do that, then you want to always be sure you go in and check your files. When you have this many photos, it's kind of hard to go through them, but I really recommend you do at least look at the thumbnails, because a lot of times when you're doing major digital transfers like this, there can always be some kind of an artifact that gets into the photo, and you might go through one of them and only half the picture's there because it happened to be where some digital artifacts got in and, you know, corrupted that one file. So that's why you want to go through and look at them, because you want to go to them 10 years from now and find out, oh, my goodness, I did this conversion, and these three photos aren't there, or they're only half there. They're really damaged.
Would it make sense to go through and look at, say, every 10th one just to kind of get a feel for it, or do you need to see them all?
I would say see them all, because chances are, you know, the needle in the haystack can be the stinker one, and knowing my luck, it would be the one that I wanted really, really bad, the one that got corrupted. And like I always told people, to err is human. To really screw up takes a computer.
There's Tom Perry, our preservation authority. If you have a question for him, you can email him at asktom@tmcplace.com. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Good to be here.
And thanks once again to Gary Boyd Roberts from the New England Historical and Genealogical Society talking about gateway ancestors today. It was a great show. If you didn't catch that discussion, listen to the podcast. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. We'll catch you again next week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.